From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll explore the economic, environmental, and cultural priorities shared by Wisconsin and Quebec.
Later, cellist Robert Cohen says he's taken inspiration from ballet dancers in learning how to prepare for his performances.
All of that warming up is just a way to prepare them to be so creative and so stunning. That's a real reminder for us as musicians to always think about where we're aiming.
And children's book author and illustrator Lori Keller explains what inspired her to anthropomorphize donuts and potatoes.
I've always been really oddly drawn to inanimate objects. Ever since I was a kid, I was absolutely sure that they had feelings, and so I was always very empathetic with them.
Lake Effect is next after the news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Soon after the first of the year, Tony Evers will be sworn in as the next governor of Wisconsin. But Evers is not the only new leader in the Great Lakes region. Illinois will soon have a new governor, as will Michigan.
And that extends across the border as well. The Canadian province of Quebec has a new premier, François Legault, who took office about 6 weeks ago. All of this means that it is a new set of leaders who will tackle issues like environmental concerns and trade in the years to come. Plenty of countries have official representatives to the Midwest, but Quebec is the only Canadian province with an office in the region. It's led by Jean-François Hould, who was in Milwaukee recently and visited with us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mitch, for having me.
I think most people might have an idea that international governments have representatives in cities outside national capitals, things like consulates versus embassies. But what's the importance for provinces such as Quebec to do the same thing?
I think, first, Quebec is the first, the only French nation in North America. Quebec has a very special way of governing itself on the world stage. For more than 50 years, Quebec has been engaging directly with partners in the Midwest on topics that fall under its provincial jurisdiction, which are economy, culture, environment, education. So we are provincial governments, for sure. So we do not offer consular services, but we work closely with our colleagues at the Canadian Consulate in our territory. Our work is targeted to state and local entities. We have 30 offices around the world. I think at the subnational level, there's no other state or province who is that engaged. We have 9 offices in the United States. That shows the importance of United States for Quebec, and I have the privilege to represent Quebec in the Midwest region.
Well, and so what does your day-to-day job involve?
And we help like Quebec companies who are exporting in the United States. Part of the office is also attracting investment. I would say that we work mainly on automotive, aerospace, everything that involves paper products, aluminum, of course. I think we're going to talk a little bit about it later. Agri-food, another big thing. We have amazing cheese in Wisconsin. We have also amazing product here in Quebec. In fact, if you have a good chance to find cookies from Quebec like on the shelf of your stores here in Wisconsin. We are working also on constructions. We had like some tariffs on softwood lumber a couple of years ago, and we worked like, on that as well. Part of the work is also advocating for environment. We work closely on environment, maritime transportation, culture as well, and we work also on institutional affairs.
Well, and we'll talk about some of those things in the next few minutes, although I kind of want to ask what cookies I should be looking for.
Oh, there's the luckiest cookies like around here. Like, and you will find also some Quebec beers on the shelves, like Unibrew.
So, as you say, you don't have consular responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Are there areas in which, the priorities of the Canadian government at large differ from Quebec's objectives, or
I said that our priorities are pretty well aligned. We work closely. We have like 4 consulates on our territory, and we work closely with those consulates. We have a great collaboration, and especially in the NAFTA USMCA conversation, we coordinate our efforts targeting officials, chambers of commerce. We did a lot of events together. We team up to promote Quebec artists sometimes, cultural activities. So there's a great collaboration. But the main goal for us is to make sure that the Quebec voice is heard and to make sure also that we can engage at the state-to-province level and build that relationship. That is, Quebec depends a lot on trade. It's a very important file for us. It's important to develop trade with the United States. It's our closest partner, our friends, our ally, as we say all the time. And I think it's really important to keep going with on that file. The other thing is, like, there's a French language thing, as I can hear with my accent. We promote French education also. We work closely with the French consulate also on that topic. We have a couple of events with the French alliances.
I was going to ask the Alliance Française.
Yes, we work with the Alliance Française all around the Midwest, helping promoting and cross-promoting their artists and our artists to make sure that people can learn that beautiful language.
Well, and speaking specifically about the Midwest, can you go into a little more detail about the specific kinds of people or companies or entities that you work with most often and how you engage with them?
We help mostly like the small and medium companies in Quebec. There's like big companies who have a strong presence, especially like in Wisconsin. We can think about BMO. It's a Quebec-based company. CN is a Quebec-based company. It's another big employer in the Midwest. Saputo, Agropur. So we like the cheese of Wisconsin, but Quebec-owned companies are producing good Wisconsin cheese as well. So we have like this. We work close mostly with the smaller companies who want to figure out what is the market, how to. And we also work with sometimes other companies who are interested in investing in Quebec. So it's a two-way street for us, looking at building this relationship. And a relationship that is already strong, I would say, Mitch, because $1.1 billion of trade, bilateral trade already exists between Wisconsin and Quebec. And there's more than 16,000 jobs were created in Wisconsin by Quebec-based companies.
And it's interesting to hear you mention it because I think most people, it doesn't even dawn on them that two big brand names that they see quite a lot of in this city, BMO and CN, are obviously both Canadian companies.
Exactly. And also how we supply companies on both sides. Like Quebec companies are suppliers for major retail banners in Wisconsin, such as Menards. So there is, we don't see where the products are from all the time, but there's more ties that we think.
Well, and of course, trade and tariffs in particular are negotiated between federal governments. Mm-hmm. With that said, I imagine trade policy affects your work quite a lot.
It did. In fact, for the last year, my team and I, worked closely with the consulates advocating for a new trade agreement between the two provinces. But one of the biggest things were targeted on tariffs recently was like softwood lumber, which is like a big thing that we export, and also everything that's linked to paper products. And the biggest thing that we export, one of the biggest things that we export in the United States is aluminum. 60% of the importation of aluminum in the United States are from Quebec, in fact. So, and most of the Canadian smelters are based in Quebec. So those tariffs have a clear impact, and it's not only us who are seeing it. Like the U.S. Chamber was very vocal on it. I read an article recently saying that there's more than $2 billion impacts from the tariffs and the trade wars in Wisconsin economy. It's not a Quebec guy with a French accent who's saying it. It's like real people from the United States who are targeting it. And companies like Front Manufacturing here, Harley-Davidson and Milwaukee were very vocal about it. Volrat also in Sheboygan and been also very vocal about it. So I think people really realize it has an impact on Wisconsin's business. And bottom line, it has an impact on the consumers. The tariffs that we saw on softwood lumber raised the price. I was talking with the American Home Association, Builders Association, and they were telling me that the impact is up to $7,000 of a house. It's money that people cannot invest other things as furniture and moving in their new home. So I think there's an impact for us. We don't like to see that. We hope that with the agreement that we reach, the tariff will be lifted. I think it's important. We are the third largest economy in the world, the Great Lakes region and the two provinces. I think we have a great opportunity to move forward together, put that trade war and those tariffs behind us and move forward and grow our economy in a win-win deal.
Well, and it sounds to me, not to put words into your mouth, but that you would think that there's some misunderstanding about who a trade war most affects.
I think it affects everybody, and basically it affects the consumers. I think that's, for me, it's clear, and I see the Great Lakes region as a corner, a crossroad, I would say, of many trade deals. Canada signed a deal with CETA recently, with the European Union called CETA. We have another trade deal with the Asian countries. We have the USMCA. We can think regionally as a great hub to develop and grow our economy together and engage in a very positive trade relationship.
You mentioned briefly before goals as far as the environment goes, yep. And Quebec and Wisconsin are both parts of the Great Lakes Compact.
Yep.
What are Quebec's priorities with respect to the Great Lakes as far as environment goes?
I was highlighting that the main purpose of our office is working on trade and the economic development. But I think for all Quebecers, we have to conjugate that development with the environment. We have to find a way, and I think the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence is a perfect way to develop that kind of model. I'm a commissioner for Quebec on the Great Lakes Commission. We work closely on Wisconsin on issues like invasive species, ballast water, make sure that we make the maritime system more competitive, but also more environmental friendly. We work closely with the maritime entity of the governors and premiers. The premiers and the governor gave themselves a strategic plan in the Great Lakes to increase the traffic, maritime traffic, and the economic growth of the region. And Quebec and Wisconsin are co-chair of the committee as well. So we work together on growing the environment, but also developing the maritime system. And hopefully we'll have like the next meeting of the governors and premiers in Milwaukee in June 2019.
Well, and I know from having interviewed people about the maritime system and the maritime traffic on through the St. Lawrence Seaway and through the Great Lakes, that there's some feeling that the St. Lawrence Seaway never quite developed to the degree as far as shipping goes that it might have. Is that a priority that you're looking at?
It is one of the main priority that we have. I think in the region there's a lot of untapped potential that we have to explore. We are working closely with Wisconsin to see how we can connect our ports, work together to make sure that some problems that we're facing through pillage, ballast water, as I was saying, are cleaned out. We work also with the other states advocating for a new SULOC. That was another that was working. A lot of things are like crossing through like, all the steel, in fact, like for the manufacturing of the cars here in the Midwest, like goes through that lock. It's really important for Quebec as well. We have some chips like Fedenav who are going through that lock on a regular basis, going all the way to Duluth. So I think there's a lot of things that has to be done. But again, I think through the compact, through the Governors and Premiers Association, through also the Great Lakes Commission, there's a way that we can talk together on a multilateral level and make sure that everybody's engaging and looking in the same direction. It's the most important thing. But, Mitch, I will say we are committed partners. We developed our own maritime plan in Quebec a couple of years ago. We were a part of the discussion when we created this strategic plan for the Great Lakes with the other states. And our new Premier Legault, which was elected last October, wrote a book a couple of years ago about the maritime plan, and I think he is really committed to developing the St. Lawrence. And growing the economy of the St. Lawrence is just good for the Great Lakes region.
I know you worked particularly in the area of cultural affairs when you were posted in New York. What can you tell us about how the culture of Quebec is represented or exported to the Midwest?
You were talking about the French Alliance, the Alliance Française. I think we have a very great relationship. In fact, yesterday night we had an amazing night with beer from Quebec and cheese from Wisconsin, celebrating like the great friendship between the province and the state. We have on a regular basis artists, singers who are coming in Milwaukee, and we work closely with the Alliance. We work also closely with University of Wisconsin here in Milwaukee. They have every February a film festival. We always have at least one Quebec movie during the film festival. It's free. So it's always a good way to have a look at it. We're going to have, I know it's not in Milwaukee, maybe eventually in Chicago, Cirque du Soleil is coming. Cirque Loise is coming next spring. The month of March, we're always coming back in Milwaukee with a strong proclamation for Le Mois de la Francophonie. Yeah.
Well, Jean-François Hulde, merci beaucoup.
It's my pleasure. Merci beaucoup.
Jean-François Hulde is the Quebec government representative to the Midwest. He is based in Chicago but was in Milwaukee on business last week, and we spoke with him then.
Keep listening. We'll take a quick break now and then talk about the intersection of music and dance with contributor and cellist Robert Cohen. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. And I'm Mitch Tyke. Dance is about creative movement on stage or the dance floor or wherever it's practiced. And when we talk about dance, it's often in terms of movement and choreography. But the music itself is an equally integral part of the equation.
Each month, we talk with contributor and cellist Robert Cohen about the work of a professional classical musician. It's a segment called On That Note. This month, Cohen spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about how the two art forms, music and dance, intersect for him.
Well, you know, it's kind of a long story because these days I often talk about ballet when I'm teaching and when I'm making references to movements in music because, you know, we sort of choreograph our movements and our movements then turn into sound through our instrument. And also I'm much more fixated about it than I used to be because I have, you know, a son who's a professional ballet dancer in the Birmingham Royal Ballet. And recently just started, in fact. And so it's now incredibly exciting to go and watch him and talk about all the things that are to do with movement and understanding the body and relating it to what I do as a cellist, but also watching the incredible discipline. And, you know, obviously he's been studying seriously since he was 11 years old. So his path has been to be a professional dancer, and that's been fascinating to watch. But just now at this time of year, it's a great time for me and my wife to get a chance finally to go and watch because, you know, this all this traveling and there's just so little time to do these wonderful things. And now we go and see him, which is exceedingly exciting. And so recently we just went to see a couple of performances and in London, and they were really fantastic. And of course there's all that just being enamored of what extraordinary things the body can do and all the sort of things that you would never dream you'd be able to do yourself. And then after the second performance that we saw, there was the following morning, there was an open class. So the company did class on stage for us to go and watch. And that's a kind of a mixed thing, really, because it's sort of something that they do every single day in private. But in this case, it was in public. So I found it fascinating from so many different points of view, because first of all, you can see the dancers that were starring the night before, and they were so extraordinarily brilliant and breathtaking. And suddenly you see them starting a class where they're moving very, very gently, obviously kind of tired from massive performance the night before, starting their warm-ups really, really gently. And they're, of course, they're not in those gorgeous costumes, but they're just in whatever ballet things that they wear every morning. So you see them in a kind of raw state, and they're moving gently and moving slowly. And then and the kind of exercises they do are ones that actually, you know, I've learned to incorporate a little bit in my own warm-ups as well.
Like what?
I've learned quite a lot from Louis, my son, which are just sort of gentle movements of wrists and ankles and knees and hips and shoulders, and no kind of abrupt movements and no really very big sort of stretchy kind of things, but things which just gradually warm the muscles, get the blood flowing, continual movements, if you like. And of course they do them in a rather beautiful way, even though they just seem to be starting their exercises. And certainly I know that I feel my whole body seems to kind of notice that it's being woken up and being prepared for something much stronger. So I've taken some of those ballet movements and I suppose the breathing and things to do with the neck and even kind of facial muscles as well, and hands, and especially hands as well for us musicians.
Well, and the breath, you just mentioned that. That's the first thing I thought of, was that, we all need breath, but musicians, of course, make music with breath as a foundation. Even if you're not blowing an instrument or singing, it's still very much part. And of course, that's true for dance too, because you're moving on breath.
Yeah, and of course, if you don't breathe, we know what happens.
Yes, it's not a good thing.
I mean, apart from the fact that your muscles seize up and your brain dies, I mean, apart from that
small thing, yes.
That small thing happens. But yeah, and of course, the difference for us is that we can breathe as we play without really thinking about it. And it just happens, and there's nothing to stop it happening, and it's not in conflict with anything. But I think with ballet, they have to sometimes be a bit more aware of when they breathe, because if they're going to do a lift or they're going to do a jump or they can't just carry on breathing in the normal way. So I think they understand breathing in more depth than we do. And that actually reminds me of it. I remember once years ago, being off stage to the side of the stage when there was a ballet company working, and the dancers were doing fantastic, athletic, beautiful things on stage. And then one of them just sort of flew off into the wings, because that was his role. And as he came off, he just let out this enormous exhale, like he'd been holding his breath for the last 10 minutes, you know. And I, of course, what's happening is that they don't want to look as though they're out of breath. They don't want to look as though they're going to be panting or that they're desperately gasping for a bit of extra breath to do some more extraordinary movements. So they have to hide all of that while they're dancing. So not only do they have to control their breath and all that movement, but they don't want us to see it in the audience. It has to seem completely effortless.
Right, and that's true for musicians too. We don't want to see the effort. We just want it to happen.
That's true, but I think that we just don't work as hard as they do.
I mean, it's a different kind of work, Robert.
Yeah, true. But I mean, it's honestly, looking from a musician's point of view and watching them doing this warm up, and then gradually as the class goes on, of course, they start to get more, they're bigger movements and more extraordinary movements. Like you see dancers put their leg right vertically up past their ear, you know, straight up to the sky, and they're still standing there perfectly straight. And you think, is that contortionism, or it's just, what is that? It's absolutely extraordinary, extreme movements that they're doing gradually more and more through their class. And then the exciting thing is finally you see them sort of doing real kind of dance exercises, you know, little bits of dance across the stage. And at that point, you really notice the beauty and the style and the, you know, what this is all aiming for. And all of that warming up, all that class before, is just a way to prepare them to be so creative and so stunning. And I think that's a real reminder for us as musicians that, you know, to always think about where we're aiming and to know that in the end it's about being creative and about doing something really breathtaking and beautiful. And yet at the same time, there's such individuality. That's what I noticed in the class, that they're all doing the same thing. So they're all doing the same kind of movements. They're being told every few moments, they're being told to do a certain exercise, and then they all do it together. And they all do it in unison. And you can see that it's really important in the ballet company that they all look exactly the same when they do it. So that there's this uniformity when they do a particular move across the stage. And you can understand that. And of course, the more uniform it is, the more perfect it seems to be when you watch. And yet what was also beautiful to watch was that kind of little tiny nuances of individual things that they do, which they can't help because it's just a personal thing. And I was reminded of that the night before, because Louis was dancing in a group, and they were wearing, it was female garde, and at the one point he was wearing a hat, and his four men were wearing hats and all very similar clothes, and I was trying to figure out which one was him, because you couldn't actually tell, and we're desperately, you know, looking, is that one Louis? No, maybe that one's Louis. And then actually when you look at them incredibly closely, you can see some identifying very, very personal little movements which you kind of latch onto, because they are, those tiny details are the ones that touch you in a way. They're really kind of very personal, minute movements. And again, that's like in music, you know, we're all playing the same piece of music, but it's those personal little adjustments of tiny things that bring the individuality and the beauty of one person's particular interpretation. And the subtleties are the biggest things somehow.
Yeah, they are. And I was going to say it's what makes a Robert Cohen performance different from some other cellist.
Yes, I think that, you know, we see that, of course, when we watch ballet companies as well. There are people that we're kind of magnetized by certain people. And we don't even know why, really. It's just something about them that's touches us or just connects with us in their own way, whereas it's something about their personality. You might go and see somebody and feel it's incredible what they can do, but I don't feel particularly attracted to what they're doing or particularly inspired. And somebody else on the stage that might be doing maybe a much lesser role that you just can't keep your eyes off, because there's something about the way they communicate that is so personal for you. And as a spectator, and to be honest, I don't spend nearly enough time watching or listening to others because I'm always so busy doing it myself. But when I do go and I'm captivated in that way, I just reminded how beautiful art forms really are to be involved in from a spectator's point of view. And not just, you know, me obsessing about what my audience will get when I play a Brahms sonata, which I tend to be focused on really very intently a lot of my work, but just getting the chance to go and watch others in a different way is enlightening for me.
Have you ever had the opportunity to perform with a dancer?
Yes, in fact, I have on many occasions.
How is that?
Well, when you mix art forms, I have to say I love the idea of mixing art forms, but it's quite complicated because when you play music, there's definitely a visual element that we talked about before, about people watching you playing and how much they get involved in your physicality as you produce the music and the music itself. And then you have somebody who's dancing, or several people, but let's just say one other person dancing on the stage with you. They bring an enormous kind of physicality to the music. They're projecting the music in a different way, but it's very visually based. And sometimes it's quite hard to cope with the two things going on at the same time. I've had quite a lot of reactions from people in the audience who've said it was amazing to see the dancers working around you and with you on the music, and other people saying, I just was so distracted. I wanted to see you all the time, or I wanted to see them all the time, and it was difficult to cope with that combination. And I think that is an issue that works for some people and not for others, and maybe with certain pieces of music more than others. But I tell you the really fantastic experience I had years ago. A few years ago, I did a project with the Royal Ballet School in London, where I helped them understand over several weeks the way that a musician works on Bach solo cello suite, and how Bach wrote the music, how we interpret it, how we include movement into it, and how the dance movements work. The whole process of us understanding and coming to perform a Bach solo cello suite. And then what we did was we had one of the students choreograph something completely new for a particular movement of the Bach six movements, and six different choreographers, one for each movement, and they choreographed some dance for several of their colleagues at school. So each movement, what happened in the end was that I was told by the choreographer, I'd like you to sit on this part of the stage when you play that movement, and then they did their dance to that particular movement. And then the next group would come and say, no, now we want you sitting here and we're going to dance around you to that music. And so I had sort of six totally different experiences, six completely different interpretations by different young dancers and choreographers. And the result was really stunning. It was amazing to see how they'd been inspired by the music, and so completely differently than I would ever have expected. So sometimes you're playing a saraband, really slow, beautiful, heartfelt music, and they were sometimes incredibly active and intense with that beauty. And other times it was the opposite extreme, and I'd be being really, really busy playing a courant or something, flying around, and they took a completely different viewpoint of how the music worked for them. And I was just amazingly inspired by a completely different take on the music by young choreographers and young dancers. And I felt that the experience of the performance itself, the whole performance, was completely unforgettable.
Did it change how you approached the music in the future?
In a way, it did. But I think the most important thing was it changed how I felt I would work with dancers in the future. Because what I realized very quickly was that they needed to be much more, the music to be much more consistent from one performance to another. So for me to play a Bach suite, I like to change things. I like to develop my ideas. Every single time I play it slightly differently, sometimes radically differently, because I feel I need to be spontaneous in a way. I feel that live element all the time, and I can take that license when I'm playing. But when the dancers have planned exactly how far they can leap or how close they can move to somebody else, they need the timing to be so amazingly consistent. And I learned very quickly that it was no good me being kind of, spontaneous, because it just didn't work for them.
Well, it sounds... It's such a wonderful thing to think about, how those two disciplines intersect and overlap and how they feed each other. Because, of course, dancers dance to music as well as, musicians using movement in how they make music. And so it's a very cool thing. Robert, as always, we went long because it was such an interesting topic this time. But I look forward to chatting with you in the new year. It's been another wonderful year of conversations with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie. It has been a fantastic year, and I hope he gets a chance to rest now.
Just a little. Just a little.
Cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month for a segment called On That Note. He talked with Bonnie North, and you can listen to past conversations with him at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then children's book author and illustrator Lori Keller journeys across Lake Michigan from her home in Muskegon. She'll discuss the many problems faced by the friendly potato at the center of her latest book. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. And this is an interview about potato pants.
But before you check the sales at Kohl's or Nordstrom or look on Amazon, we should point out an important fact. Potato pants aren't real. They are a figment of the very active imagination of children's book author Lori Keller.
Keller also brought the world Arnie the Donut, The Scrambled States of America, and other titles. She lives directly across Lake Michigan from us in Muskegon, Michigan, but found her way to Milwaukee recently, where we had a chance to catch up with her. Lori Keller, it is honestly a thrill to have you here.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much.
I think I have probably gone 7 or 8 years without asking a question quite as obvious as where do you get your ideas? But I'm looking at a book about a talking potato and his pants-related identity crisis.
Yes.
And I feel like this is a perfectly valid juncture to ask, where in the world does this come from?
Well, a lot of my ideas pop into my head. The very first book I made was The Scrambled States of America, and it's been 20 years now. I can't even believe it. Yeah, and that one literally popped into my head one night when I was falling asleep, pretty much the way you see it on the cover there with little states with arms and legs, faces. Several of them popped into my head, and I don't know why, but the next morning I remembered that, and I thought, well, maybe that would be a fun way to teach kids U.S. geography, and I wrote a story around that idea and found a publisher pretty quickly, and I've been working with them ever since. So in Potato Pants was similar. A lot of times, you know, like with Arnie the Donut, something will inspire me. Like I went into a Krispy Kreme donut shop, watched the donuts being made, and thought, okay, I want to write
about
a donut.
Why not anthropomorphize them?
Why not? And then with Potato Pants, I was working on another one of the Arnie the Donut chapter books, doing some artwork for that, and for some reason, I still don't know why, a conversation between a potato and a snooty boutique owner popped into my head. And again, I don't know why, but I stopped what I was doing, and I spent a couple hours jotting down their conversation and then built the story from there.
Does it take something to not self-censor yourself when a thought like that comes in your head? I mean, I think the idea, if I were to suddenly have this thought of a talking potato, I'm not sure I would file it under things I could use.
Well, I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate, but those thoughts don't usually happen until a couple of years after it's been published. And then I'll be reading it to somebody, and it's like, wait, this is really weird. But no, I kind of just go with it. I've always been really oddly drawn to inanimate objects. Ever since I was a kid, I was absolutely sure that they had feelings. And so I was always very empathetic with them and pairing them up so they had a friend or whatever it was. And I figured I would grow out of that. But I've just basically turned it into a career.
I think a lot of kids do, and I don't know when we lose that idea.
I haven't. I'm still.
Well, and one of the things that always strikes me about your books is that many of the pages kind of have a comic strip feel to them. They're in multiple panels, you know, like the six things that happened to Arnie the Donut the morning that the book starts.
Oh, right.
Did you ever have dreams of drawing a comic strip?
Well, you know what? I know a lot of kids do nowadays, and we talk about that, but I was very interested in comics. I loved Nancy, Richie Rich, Little Lulu were my three favorites. But I didn't realize, I guess, that just regular people like me did that sort of thing. So I just kind of always drew just for the fun of it, but never really thought about doing it for a career in any way until I was much older. So
what were you doing before the Scrambled States came along?
Oh, well, I worked my first job as an artist. I worked at Hallmark Cards in Kansas City, Missouri as a greeting card illustrator. And I started doing a little bit of writing there when I got the chance. And then it was when, well, I actually started to spend some time in a nearby children's bookstore to be inspired for kids' art. And I don't have kids myself, so I hadn't looked at children's books in many years. And I was going through these books. I started collecting them, and I just couldn't believe, you know, all these wonderful books. Two of the ones that inspired me the most were Lane Smith and John Cheska. Are you familiar with
the
them?
The Stinky Cheese Man.
Stinky Cheese Man. Oh,
which
my
is,
gosh.
We were talking about this before we were rolling tape, and I mentioned that I bought a copy of Arnie the Donut before I had kids. The other children's book that I bought before I had kids was the Stinky Cheese Man.
Really? Oh, yeah. That's one of my just all-time favorites. I loved how irreverent it was and so funny, and that was one of the books that just made me think, that's what I want to do someday, is make books. And so a couple of years later was when the Scrambled States idea popped into my head.
Well, and the thing now that you mention it, that your stuff has in common with the Stinky Cheese Man is, and obviously some other books too, is the dialogue that the characters kind of have with the reader as the book is playing out. Mm, it's this kind of playful interaction that, you know, to get really heady here, takes the fourth wall away.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Right. Yeah, that's becoming more and more common in books, making them more interactive. And I think kids really like that. And I know librarians kind of like that, too, when they do read-alouds. And it's just fun if it happens to work out in the story to do that. But it's a fun way to have a character relate to the kids a little bit more in that way.
Your books can be tricky, I will say, to read aloud just because of the many asides and the kind of digressions. Does that enter your mind as you're putting together a book, how people will not only read it to themselves but read it out loud?
Well, not
so much. And that's not
a
criticism.
No, I know, but it really didn't at first. And I think, again, it was because maybe since I don't have kids, so I didn't really ever think about that over the years. And they weren't saying it as a complaint, but sometimes I would hear, they were almost like apologizing to me. Librarians would say, okay, I can't read, or I haven't been able to read all the extra little asides because it would take too long. And I totally get that. But then other people really like them because a lot of those are kind of silly jokes, maybe, that sometimes kids don't even get those, but maybe adults will. And I've learned that kids like to choose my books at bedtime because then they get to stay up an extra 15 minutes because they get to read every little aside going on. So, you know, I like to do it sometimes just for fun, for added jokes, or maybe if there's a little bit of information I want to include that doesn't really fit in the story. But Potato Pants, it didn't really seem like it needed quite so many of those, so it is a much quicker read, probably the quickest of any of the picture books that I've done.
Definitely quicker than the Scrambled States.
It is.
Talent show.
Yes, and the whole, that's a long one. But Potato Pants, just the feel of the story and just what's going on, it's so manic and fast-paced that I felt like if I added too many asides, it would really slow the story down. There were a few times when I was going to add some of those in, and I took them out because it was slowing it down too much.
The thing that really gets me about Potato Pants that I don't know that I noticed as much in your other books is the way you play with fonts.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at the page where the potato complains that the eggplant has ruined everything,
right.
And it's in very large. It's just the different fonts that show up over the course of the book are really, they're fun.
Yeah. I think that started years ago when I was a greeting card artist. But, you know, with books, it kind of helps sometimes just to get across a certain feeling or maybe how it should be read or just as a suggestion, you know. But, yeah, I think in Potato Pants I did kind of play around with the font a little bit more.
Can you walk us through a day in the life of a children's book author and illustrator in North Muskegon, Michigan.
Well,
I'm sure it is all glamour.
Oh, all glamour. My goodness. I don't even know where to start. Let's see. I don't really have typical days. I mean, and it really depends on what phase of the book I'm at, because since I write and illustrate, when I start the writing, you know, I'm back to square one, blank page. So it takes me a while to kind of build up. I'll start jotting down little notes and get going. And the writing could take a couple months. It could take a couple years. I mean, unfortunately, if it takes years, I'm usually working on something else at the same time, too. So the writing part.
What are the books that have taken years for you?
Okay. The longest one, it was Due Unto Otters, this book I did about manners and the Golden Rule, and it just took me so long to figure out a way to make a book about manners and the Golden Rule fun. So I would start it and work on it for a long time, and then I wasn't getting anything I liked, so I put it aside for a while, did another book. And so I was working on two other books during that time, but by the time I figured it out, it was about 5 years that it took me to write it. So anyway, so the writing part, I'll work, you know, kind of on and off throughout a day for however long it takes me to write it. And then when I get to the illustration part, it usually has taken me so long to write it that I don't really have as much time as I would love to illustrate it. So it takes me about 3 or 4 months working from early morning until the wee hours of the night, pretty much 7 days a week for about 3 or 4 months until the artwork is done.
It is at least fortunate when you're talking about donuts and potatoes that they are all generally similarly shaped.
That's right. And they're not that hard to draw. So when I did scrambled states, you know, I had to make sure that every little state was drawn just so that it was recognizable. But with potatoes, not so much.
Do you have a sense for what kind of ratio you have in terms of the ideas that hit you and projects you start and the projects you see through to fruition?
Wow, that's a good question. Maybe 5% of the ones make it through all the way to the end. I'll have ideas that I keep in a notebook or on little napkins or little pieces of paper that kind of end up wherever, but I don't often even use those. It's usually something that will either pop into my head that I get excited about or some little thing that crosses my path that I want to work on. And fortunately, I work with an editor who is so wonderful. She doesn't hold me to any certain idea if I'm really excited about something else, and she really likes it too. So, and she works with so many different people with so many different ways of working, that, and she really is a creative person herself, so she understands the whole process and is really great with how everybody, their individual ways of working.
It has to be wonderful to work with someone who you could bring an idea like potato pants to, and and they say great.
it's been, there haven't been too many ideas that I've been excited about that she hasn't been excited about, too.
How challenging for you is the cover of the book? I mean, you know, we always talk about not judging a book by its cover, but, I mean, especially when you're 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 years old, and frankly, when you're an adult, there is a lot of judging a book by its cover, especially when it's a picture book.
Right. Yeah, it's tricky. And the title is really tricky, too. Titles are probably the hardest thing for me. A lot of people have the title right away, and I don't usually. Potato Pants, I did. I knew right away what I wanted it to be called. But that one, the cover, I had a hard time with. I usually design the covers myself, but I kept turning in ideas for the cover, and they just weren't working out so well. And so there's a designer that I work with, too, at Henry Holt McMillan, and she was the one that suggested basically the way the cover turned out, and I was so happy with that direction.
Right, the cover is almost, I don't know, I'm not sure how to describe the cover.
He's just super excited about the possibility of Potato Pants.
And he's got this montage of other potatoes and their pants.
They're all shopping
buying.
Like crazy, flying off the racks. And then in the background lurks the menacing eggplant.
Who does not know he is menacing,
no,
as
it turns
out. No, he
doesn't realize that at all.
Spoiler alert there.
That's right. That's right.
Does it surprise you when a character like Arnie turns into what Arnie has kind of turned into?
Like becoming popular with kids?
Yeah, or? Becoming popular with kids. I mean, I have not seen it personally, but I gather there is like an Arnie mascot out there.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And you never, I mean, you don't know. You don't know what will resonate with kids. And that's why I don't really try to figure that out when I'm working on a book, because you just couldn't try to figure that out. And so I just make what entertains me, basically. I don't test it out on kids. And I just hope that it makes other people laugh.
So then when you go out and you do author events, as you are doing here in Milwaukee today, mm-hmm. is there still somewhat of the unknown when you walk into a classroom full of kids?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, especially the first few times I read it to somebody. Yeah, I never know if they'll like it or not. And it always surprises me at the parts that they really laugh at, or something maybe that I thought they might laugh at that kind of just slips by, and it's different with every group. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of always surprising.
Lori Keller, thank you so much for what you do and for sharing it with us.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much for having me.
And come back and see us again.
I would love that.
Children's book author and illustrator Lori Keller's latest book is called Potato Pants. She is also the author of quite a few other books for young readers, including Arnie the Donut, The Scrambled States of America, and Due Unto Otters. She lives in Muskegon, Michigan, but stopped by our studio during a recent visit to Milwaukee for a Boswell Book Company event. Today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.